It was a polite refusal, and Esau, rather gloweringly, understood it as such. He made indeed another trial, suggesting to his brother that he should leave some of his people with him to lead the train and to cover its rear. But Jacob thanked him and said there was no need, if only he found grace in the sight of his Lord, so that the emptiness of his words stood revealed. Esau shrugged his shaggy shoulders, turned his back on the fine and false one, and went hence into his mountains with cattle and train. Jacob, behind him, lingered a little, then at the first turning, took another way and disappeared. Chapter 3. The Story of Dinah. The Little Maid. Since he came next to Shechem, it is here in place to tell the tale of the grievous complications that ensued from his sojourn there, and to tell them, moreover, as they really came to pass, with some correction of those little adornments and improvements which crept in later into the fine language, beginning with, "Knowest thou? Well I know," and were then handed down to posterity as the history of the seed and of the world. For if I unfold the story of the evil and in the end bloody doings of that time, a story inscribed in Jacob's lined and weary old lineaments, along with other events that made up the burden of his ancient memories, it is because it forms part of the man's spiritual history, the character of his soul, and because nothing is better calculated than his attitude in this episode to explain why Simeon and Levi secretly poked each other in the ribs when their father made use of the title and honor bestowed upon him by divine grace. The hapless heroine of the adventure at Shechem was Dinah, Jacob's only daughter, who was born of Leah at the beginning of her second period of fruitfulness, at the beginning and not at the end, and thus before Issachar and Zebulun, and not after them, as later tradition would have it. This tradition must be wrong, for according to it, Dinah would have been still unripe and physically too young for the misfortune which befell her. She would have been still a mere child. Actually, she was 4 years older than Joseph, which would make her 9 at the time of Jacob's arrival at Shechem, and 13 at the time of the catastrophe. 2 important years older, that is, than tradition would have her, for in those 2 years she flowered, became a woman, and as attractive as it was given to any child of Leah to be. Yes, for a brief space, more attractive than might have been expected from this strong but unlovely stock. She was a true child of the Mesopotamian steppe, where no living summer follows the early burgeoning and flowery spring, for even in May all the enchanting loveliness is burnt black as a coal by a pitiless sun. Such were Dinah's natural parts, to which events added their share to make of her before her time a weary and a wasted woman. As for her place in the list of Jacob's descendants, it is of no great importance what the scribes have set down. It was haste or indifference that guided their pens when they simply entered her name at the end of the list of Leah's children instead of in its right place. They would not interrupt the tale of sons by anything at once so petty and so annoying as a girl's name. It did not matter about a girl. There was not much to choose between actual barrenness and the birth of a female, and Dinah's name in the place where it belongs forms, as it were, a transition between Leah's brief period of sterility and the ensuing period of fruitfulness, which began in earnest and properly with the advent of Issachar. Every schoolboy knows today that Jacob had 12 sons. Some even know their names by heart, whereas large circles of the population are unaware that the unhappy little Dinah ever existed, and when she is mentioned, display surprise. But she was dear to Jacob, as dear as a child of the unchosen one could be. He hid her from Esau in a coffin, and when her time came, his heart bled for her. Baset. Israel, then, the blessed of the Lord, with all his goods and possessions, his flocks, of which the sheep alone were 5,500 head, with his women and their increase, with male and female slaves, shepherds and drovers, with asses and goats and pack and riding camels, in good spirits at having left behind the heat of the river valley and the dangers from the wild boars and leopards hidden in its poplar and willow thickets, Jacob the father found himself in a moderately mountainous region where rushing streams watered the blooming and fruitful valleys, and barley was growing wild. In one such valley, he happened upon the city of Shechem, a pleasant place, shaded by the rock Gerizim. It was centuries old, with a ring wall of unmortised blocks of stone enclosing two cities, a lower one to the southwest, an upper to the northeast. The upper one was so called because it stood upon an artificial mound 5 double ells in height, but likewise in a figurative sense, because it consisted almost entirely of the palace of Hamor, prince of the city, together with the square massif of the temple of Baal-Berith. These two towering structures were the first things to meet the eyes of Jacob and his train as they entered the valley and approached the eastern gate. Shechem had some 1,500 inhabitants, not counting the 20 men who formed the Egyptian garrison, and whose commander, an officer in the heyday of youth, came from the Delta region and was set here for the sole purpose of collecting each year certain bars of gold in ring form from the hands of Hamor, but indirectly from the large merchants of the lower city. This gold had then to take its way down to the city of Ammon, and its failure to arrive would have been attended by great personal inconvenience to the young Weser K. Bastet, such being the name of the captain. One can imagine the mixed feelings with which the people of Shechem regarded the approach of that straggling train, having been informed of it by the guards on the walls and by homecoming citizens. Who could tell whether it was for good or evil the wanderers came? And if the latter, the people of Shechem had already enough experience of wars and plundering expeditions on their own side to make them feel misgivings for the safety of their city, despite the thick wall that went round it. These were not martial spirits, but rather peaceful, trading, comfortable souls. Hamor, the prince, was a peevish old man, with painfully enlarged joints, and his son, Sychem, a pampered young gentleman, an elegant drone who lay upon rugs and ate sweetmeats. Under such conditions, the reliance of the population upon the soldierly valor of the occupying garrison would have been warm and joyous had there been any ground whatsoever for such confidence to rest upon. But this little troop of men, under a falcon standard decorated with peacock feathers, though it called itself the division refulgent as the solar disk, did not awaken any hopes of reliance in the hour of need, and least of all their captain, the aforementioned Weser K. Bastet, who had as good as nothing of the soldier about him. He was a bosom friend of the young Sychem, and he had himself two passions in life, flowers and cats. He came from the city of P. Beset in Lower Egypt, and in fact was known to the Shechemites simply as Beset. The local divinity of his city was the cat-headed goddess Bastet, and Beset's devotion to the feline species knew no bounds. Wherever he went, he was surrounded by these animals, not only living ones of all colors and ages, but dead ones as well, for several mummies stood against the walls of his quarters, and he wept as he laid before them offerings of mice and milk. With this softness of disposition went his love of flowers. As a counterpose to masculine traits, it might have been thought of as a pleasing characteristic, but in the absence of these, it did not inspire confidence. He went about always wearing a wide collar of fresh flowers, and however humble the article of his daily use, all must have fresh garlands. In short, the whole thing was absurd. His clothing was entirely civilian. A white batiste skirt, through which the loincloth was visible, swathings round his arms and waist. No one had ever seen him in a cuirass, or armed with anything more warlike than a little cane. Simply on the score of a certain skill at writing, he had been made an officer. As to his men, about whom he troubled himself hardly at all, they had forever on their lips, in polished sentences, praises of the warlike deeds of an early king of their country, Thothmes III, and of the Egyptian army, who, in 7 campaigns under his leadership, had conquered the whole land to the Euphrates River. But for themselves, they revealed their prowess chiefly in the destruction of roast goose and beer. On other occasions, as for instance an outbreak of fire or an attack by Bedouins upon the outlying villages belonging to the town, they had shown themselves arrant cowards, and particularly the born Egyptians among them, for there were also some yellow Libyans and a few Moors from Nubia. Sometimes they would show themselves in the narrow lanes of Shechem with their wooden shields, their lances, sickles, and three-cornered leather aprons, and run in crouching quickstep, as though in flight, through the press of donkeys and camel-riders, of melon and water-sellers and peddlers before the bazaar, and the citizens would make faces at them behind their backs. As for the rest, these warriors of Pharaoh amused themselves with games of how many fingers, or who hit you, and songs about the hardships of the soldier's life, particularly of those who were condemned to live in this miserable Amun land, instead of flourishing on the shores of the many-barked life-giver, and beneath the gaily colored columns of No, the city of cities, the city incomparable, No Amun, the city of God. That they cared no more for the fate or the protection of Shechem than a grain of corn admits of no doubt whatever. The Admonishing. But the good citizens of Shechem would have felt even worse had they heard the conversation which the older sons of the head of the tribe were having among themselves as they came on. Discussion of plans concerning Shechem all too nearly, which these dusty but energetic young people were concocting among themselves before bringing them to the ears of their father, who indeed, when he heard them, vetoed them decisively. Reuben, or Reubain, as the eldest was really named, was then 17. Simeon and Levi counted 16 and 15 years. Bilhah's Dan, a sly and ingenious youth, was likewise 15, and the swift, slim Naphtali, of like age with the strong but brooding Judah, namely 14. These were the sons of Jacob who took part in the conspiracy. Gad and Asher, 11 and 12, though already sturdy youths and mentally ripe, had no share at this time, nor, of course, the three youngest sons. What were they discussing? Well, it was the same theme as gave the Shechemites food for discussion inside the wall. These were stout fellows who put their heads together outside, burnt nearly black with Neharina's sun, their hair stiff with grease, clad in shaggy, belted smocks. Shepherds and sons of the steppe they were, running almost wild since infancy, ready with bow and knife, used to encounters with lions and wild bulls, and also to wholesale brawling with strange herdsmen over pasture rights. Very little of Jacob's mild and pensive piety had come down to them. Their concerns were strictly practical, their minds full of the youthful spirit of defiance which forever looks for insults and seeks out quarrels. They were arrogantly proud of their race, though knowing naught of the spiritual nobility upon which its true greatness rested. It was long since they had been under a roof or had settled habitation, and their attitude towards the inhabitants of the fertile land they were now entering was that of nomads, conscious of superior freedom and audacity, and occupied with visions of booty. It was Dan who first, out of the corner of his mouth, made the suggestion that they should take Shechem by guile and plunder it. Reuben, a high-minded lad, but prey to rash enthusiasms, was quickly won, while Simeon and Levi, biggest brawlers of the lot, danced and shouted in their zeal to begin. The younger ones came in out of pride at being asked. The idea was, after all, not so fantastic. It had happened before that towns in the region had been besieged by desert marauders, Kabiri or Bedouins, and even temporarily occupied. It was not precisely an everyday occurrence, yet not a rare one. Tradition, however, the sources of which are not the cities, but the Kabiri, the Ibrim, in the narrower sense of the word, the Ben Israel, keeps silence with the best conscience in the world, and convinced of the permissibility of such epic purifications of reality, upon the fact that a settlement with Shechem by force of arms was always contemplated by those in Jacob's camp, and was only delayed for a few years by the opposition of the head of the tribe. Delayed, that is, until the tragic events in connection with Dinah. In any case, Jacob opposed, and his opposition was majestic and impregnable. His mood at the time was a particularly lofty one, the combined product of his traditional culture, the singular importance of his soul life, and his inclination to far-reaching associations of ideas. In his solemn musings, the course of his life for the past 25 years appeared to him in the light of his relation to the cosmos, as a symbol of the circle, as an up and down of ascension, descent into hell, and resurrection, as an exceedingly happy fulfillment of the mystical schema of growth. Journeying from Beersheba, he had arrived at Bethel, the place of the great vision of the ladder. That was the ascension. Thence into the valleys of the underworld, where he had had to serve 27 years, sweating and freezing. Afterwards growing very rich by outwitting a sly and silly devil called Laban. Jacob's associational habit of thought drove him to see in his Mesopotamian father-in-law a black moon demon and evil dragon who had betrayed him, and whom he had then consummately betrayed and plundered, and in particular freed from his spell his Ishtar, the sweet-eyed Rachel, breaking the bolts of the lower world and mounting with her and all his riches, his heart bursting with godly laughter, out of the lower world and journeying toward Shechem. The vale of Shechem had no need to be so full of blossom as it actually was, for Jacob's eyes to greet it as a new spring and station of renewal on the course of his life. Thoughts of Abraham, standing in this very place, did their part towards filling him with tender and reverent feeling as he drew near. His sons, perchance, might dwell upon Abraham's warlike deeds, his bold assault upon the armies of the east, and how he had blunted the teeth of the stargazers. But he, Jacob, was thinking of his forefather's friendship with Melchizedek, high priest of Shechem, of the blessing he had from him, the sympathy and recognition he had paid to Abraham's God. And thus the reception which Jacob gave his older sons when tentatively, and in almost poetic language, they hinted at their unseemly intentions, was of the most unfavorable. "Depart from me," he cried, "and straightway, sons of Leah and of Bilhah, shame upon your heads. Are we thieves of the desert, who come like grasshoppers over the land, and like a plague from God, and devour the husbandman's harvest? Are we rabble and a nameless tribe, sons of nobody, whose only choice is to beg or to steal? Was not Abraham a prince among the princes of the land, and a brother of mighty powers? If ye set yourselves with dripping swords against the lords of the cities, and live among wars and alarms, how then shall ye pasture our lambs on hostile ground, and our goats among hills that resound with hatred? Away, fools! Submit yourselves! Look to the flocks, and see that the 3-week-olds take to their fodder, that the milk of the mothers may be saved. Go gather camel's hair, that we may have frieze for the garments of slaves and under-shepherds, for now is the time of shedding. Go, I say, and try the cords of the tents, and the eyelets of the tent roofs, that nothing be rotted, and a mischance come about and pull down the house of Israel about our heads. But know ye that I now gird myself up, and go forth, and enter the gate of the city, and speak in peace and wisdom with the people, and with Hamor their shepherd, that we may make covenant with them, lawfully and in writing, and have land of them, and trade to our profit, and to the harm of none."